The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the first of a new series of Guardian Reader events, which we will be featuring on the Books podcast over the autumn and beyond, alongside our usual podcasts. I'm Claire Armistead, Books Editor of The Guardian and Observer. We're starting where we mean to continue, at the top, with Ian McEwan discussing his latest novel, The Children Act. As you may remember when we met him at the Charleston Literary Festival in the spring, it's the story of a High Court judge in the family division. Her daily task is to rule on disputes such as the custody of children. But the central plotline involves a teenager in hospital with leukemia who is refusing a blood transfusion that doctors say could save his life. Meanwhile, the judge's own life and childless marriage are in some turmoil. Before Ian started talking to host Jonathan Friedland, he read from the opening of the novel.
Yes, we thought it would be a good idea to have a reading, but not too long. And because I'm going to read from the very beginning, it won't require an awful lot of introduction. Anyone can tell they're getting slightly older and getting on in life when you count among your friends high court judges. I have one or two now, and I've become very interested in their conversation and in their judgments. And their judgments do seem to me, at their best, a neglected subgenre of our literature. And I've become very interested in the judgments of the family division. Often the family division is about love and the end of love, of issues relating to death, the destinies, often contested, of children, then of medical care, medical ethics. All of the 19th century novel and some of the 20th century novel is there, and that's what brought me into this subject. And you'll hear at the beginning of this novel that it is not possible to enter the courts of law without making a nod, a bow, a curtsy towards one of the great English novels of the 19th century about the law, Bleak House. London, Trinity term 1 week old, implacable June weather. Fiona May, a High Court judge, at home on Sunday evening, supine on a chaise longue, staring past her stocking feet towards the end of the room, towards a partial view of recessed bookshelves by the fireplace, and to one side, by a tall window, a tiny Renoir lithograph of a bather bought by her 30 years ago for £50, probably a fake. Below it, centered on a round walnut table, a blue vase, no memory of how she came by it, nor when she last put flowers in it. The fireplace not lit in a year. Blackened raindrops falling irregularly into the grate with a ticking sound against balled-up yellowing newsprint. A Bukhara rug spread on a wide, polished floorboard. Looming at the edge of vision, a baby grand piano bearing silver-framed family photos on its deep black shine. On the floor, by the chaise longue, within her reach, the draft of a judgment. And Fiona was on her back, wishing all this stuff at the bottom of the sea. In her hand was her second scotch and water. She was feeling shaky still, recovering from a bad moment with her husband. She rarely drank, but the Talisker and tap water was a balm, and she thought she might cross the room to the sideboard for a third. Less scotch, more water, for she was in court tomorrow and she was duty judge now, available for any sudden demand, even as she lay recuperating. He had made a shocking declaration and placed an impossible burden on her. For the first time in years, she had actually shouted, and some faint echo still resounded in her ears. You idiot. You fucking idiot. She had not sworn out loud since her carefree teenage visits to Newcastle, though a potent word sometimes intruded on her thoughts when she heard self-serving evidence or an irrelevant point of law. And then, not long after that, wheezy with outrage, she had said loudly at least twice, "How dare you?" It was hardly a question, but he answered it calmly. "I need it. I'm 59. This is my last shot. I've yet to hear evidence for an afterlife." a pretentious remark, and she had been lost for a reply. She simply stared at him, and perhaps her mouth was open. In the spirit of the staircase, she had a response now on the chaise longue. 59, Jack. You're 60. It's pathetic. It's banal. What she had actually said, lamely, was, "This is too ridiculous." And he said, "Fiona, when did we last make love?" Well, when did they? He had asked this before in moods plaintive to querulous, but the crowded recent past can be difficult to recall. The family division teemed with strange differences, special pleading, intimate half-truths, exotic accusation. And as in all branches of law, fine-grained particularities of circumstance needed to be assimilated at speed. Last week, she heard final submissions from divorcing Jewish parents, unequally orthodox, disputing their daughter's education. The draft of her completed judgment was on the floor beside her. Tomorrow, coming before her again, would be a despairing Englishwoman, gaunt, pale, highly educated mother of a 5-year-old girl, convinced, despite assurances to the court to the contrary, that her daughter was about to be removed from the jurisdiction by the father, a Moroccan businessman and strict Muslim, to a new life in Rabat, where he intended to settle. Otherwise, routine wrangles over residence of children, over houses, pensions, earnings, inheritance. It was the larger estates that came to the High Court. Wealth mostly failed to bring extended happiness. Parents soon learned the new vocabulary and patient procedures of the law and were dazed to find themselves in vicious combat with the one they once loved. And waiting off stage, boys and girls first named in the court documents, troubled little Bens and Sarahs huddling together while the gods above them fought to the last, from the Family Proceedings Court to the High Court to the Court of Appeal. All this sorrow had common themes. There was a human sameness to it, but it continued to fascinate her. She believed she brought reasonableness to hopeless situations. On the whole, she believed in the provisions of family law. In her optimistic moments, she took it as a significant marker in civilization's progress to fix in the statutes the child's needs above the parents. Her days were full, and in the evenings recently, various dinners, something at Middle Temple for a retiring colleague, a concert at King's Place, Schubert, Scriabin, and taxis, tube trains, dry cleaning to collect, a letter to draft about a special school for the cleaning lady's autistic son, and finally sleep. Where was the sex? At that moment, she couldn't recall. She said, "I don't keep a record." He spread his hands, resting his case. She had watched as he crossed the room and poured himself a measure of scotch, the Talisker she was drinking now. Lately, he was looking taller, easier in his movements. While his back was turned to her, she had a cold premonition of rejection, of the humiliation of being left for a young woman, of being left behind, useless and alone. She wondered if she should simply go along with anything he wanted. Then she rejected the thought. He'd come back towards her with his glass. He wasn't offering her a Sancerre the way he usually did around this time. She said, "What do you want, Jack?" "I'm going to have this affair." "You want a divorce?" "No, I want everything the same. No deception." "I don't understand." And he said, "Yes, you do. Didn't you once tell me that couples in long marriages aspire to the condition of siblings? We've arrived, Fiona. I've become your brother. It's cozy and sweet, and I love you. But before I drop dead, I want one big, passionate affair." Mistaking her amazed gasp for laughter, for mockery, perhaps, he said roughly, "Ecstasy, almost blacking out with the thrill of it. Remember that? I want one last go, even if you don't. Or perhaps you do." She stared at him in disbelief. "There it is, then." This was when she found her voice and told him what kind of idiot he was. She had a powerful grip on what was conventionally correct. That he had, as far as she knew, always been faithful, made his proposition all the more outrageous. Or if he'd deceived her in the past, he'd done it brilliantly. She already knew the name of the woman, Melanie, not so remote from the name of a fatal form of skin cancer. She knew she could be obliterated by his affair with this 28-year-old statistician. She said, "If you do this, it'll be the end for us. It's as simple as that." "Is this a threat?" She said, "It's my solemn promise." By then, she had regained her temper, and it did seem simple. The moment to propose an open marriage was before the wedding, not 35 years later. To risk all they had so that he might relive a passing sensual thrill. When she tried to imagine wanting something like it for herself, her last fling would be her first. She could think only of disruption, assignments, disappointment, ill-timed phone calls, the sticky business of learning to be with someone new in bed, newly devised endearments, all the fakery, and finally, the necessary disentangling, the effort required to be open and sincere, and nothing quite the same when she came away. No, she preferred an imperfect existence, the one she had now. But on the chaise longue, it rose before her, the true extent of the insult, how he was prepared to pay for his pleasures with her misery. Ruthless. She had seen him single-minded at the expense of others, most often in a good cause. This was new. What had changed? He had stood erect, feet well apart as he poured his single malt, the fingers of his free hand moving to a tune in his head, some shared song perhaps, not shared with her. Hurting her and not caring. That was new. He had always been kind, loyal and kind, and kindness, the family division daily proved, was the essential human ingredient. She had the power to remove a child from an unkind parent, and she sometimes did, but remove herself from an unkind husband. When she was weak and desolate, where was her protective judge?
So very characteristically for an Ian McEwan novel, in a very short space of time, you've established a huge amount there, this marriage that's hit a crisis, but also the professional life of your main character. The case that she then has to deliberate is one that centres on a young man, not yet 18, who's raised as a Jehovah's Witness, who's medically requires treatment that will involve the transfusion of blood, forbidden by Jehovah's Witnesses. And she, Fiona May, the judge, has to decide whether or not that operation can go ahead or whether the parents' wishes should be paramount. And as the very day the book comes out, people are following on the news, the story of this five-year-old child, Ishaya King. The case is very, very different, but his parents are Jehovah's Witnesses and the case centres on medical treatment and their battle with the authorities. You obviously could have had no idea this was coming, but just as you are reading and talking to audiences and interviewers about your book, what have you made of this story playing out with really quite uncanny timing?
Well, I'm glad I kept my mouth shut. This seems to be one of those cascades of chaos that follow through a bureaucracy. It's still not clear to us, but it's perfectly possible that the parents are, certainly they're Jehovah's Witnesses, but they're not idiots. When you press the button, as the CPS did here, on a European arrest warrant, you unleash most terrible consequences. Parents in handcuffs, they don't need to be in handcuffs. Bullying sergeants shouting, vamos, as he shoves them into the back of the... And a frightened, lonely child in a hospital ward, 5 years old, wondering where everyone's gone, his siblings and his parents. Actually, this child might now get the very best of treatment that is available so that all parties will be satisfied. And it doesn't touch anything on anything like the tragedy that does recur every year, virtually every month, somewhere, usually in the Anglophone world, when a teenager is in hospital needing a blood transfusion, is old enough to know his or her own mind in the English-Welsh jurisdiction, as in Scottish and right across the common law world, to treat someone against their will is criminal assault. Hospitals are reluctant to do it, they go to the courts, and here, as is elsewhere, there's something like the Children Act, which requires the court to put the child's interests paramount. That is the paramount consideration. And I couldn't find a single court, except for one long ago in the American Deep South, that doesn't rule for the hospital, even though the child is almost 18. But quite regularly, that same child, now an adult, a year or two later, comes back, needs another transfusion, refuses it, and dies.
Because once the child is over 18, they can make their own decision and reject medical treatment.
Beyond the reach of the court.
And you begin the book, actually, with a quotation from the Children Act itself, which establishes this point about welfare. When a court determines any question with respect to the upbringing of a child, the child's welfare shall be the court's paramount consideration. So it's an unusual thing to quote a bill from an act from 1989 at the beginning of a novel, but you do it there. And there's been so much recently in our national conversation about our attitudes to children and their welfare, and the implication, the suggestion that we are somehow, as a society, neglecting the welfare of our children.
We are now deep in a great deal of national soul searching of the extent to which children are left unprotected. Then, at the other end of the spectrum, is genuine concern of the extent to which social workers, frightened of making mistakes, are often seizing children from parents and sending them off to care homes inappropriately, often on the say-so of experts who are not properly investigated by the judge, on all sorts of weird assumptions that experts know things that ordinary people and ordinary parents do not. Terrible miscarriages of justice occur. You can go on websites, thousands of names of people, and these are the only the ones who've been successfully appealed. Many people languish in prison because the system has got it or got them wrong.
Overall, though, in the book, I think you are unusually well disposed towards lawyers. I mean, people tell lawyer jokes, and
yes, there are lots of lawyers.
You know, they're an unpopular group.
From Shakespeare onwards, yeah, there are lawyer jokes. I have to say that lawyers love jokes against lawyers. In fact, I stole one for this book, and it's a story in an American court of a pathologist being cross-examined. So how did you know that the victim was dead? And the pathologist says, well, because his brain was in a jar on my desk. And the cross-examiner says, yes, but can you be really sure he was dead? And the pathologist says, well, I guess he could have been practicing law somewhere. I'd rather stand in a British court than in a Saudi Arabian court or a Russian court. Mm. We do maintain a separation. The judiciary can be often and usefully and heroically a great nuisance to government, and we have quite a firm tradition of that. Even if David Cameron wanted someone to swing, he would have a very hard time persuading a judge to do it on his say-so. Mm. I mean, if we discovered it was ever to the contrary, it would bring down the collapse of a government. The language of the best judgments are extraordinary. And the ones I started reading were those of Sir Alan Ward, who was for a long time in the family division. He was the one who judged extraordinary and tragic case in 2000 of the Siamese twins that had to be separated, and I based something on that. They're witty, these judgments, or skepticism. The historical, philosophical range of reference is wonderful.
And yet, as you said there, they're writing for the smallest kind of audience, aren't they? Mainly each other.
Yes. Judges do read each other, as I discovered. They really do sit on each other's cases, as it were. Rather like novelists, I thought. Like novelists, at least, they're toughest on those who are foolish enough to be absent from the conversation.
And what about her, Fiona May, your fictional judge at the centre of it? She simultaneously, even while, you don't want to say her life is falling apart, but while there is crisis in her life, she retains her professional discipline, and she's dispensing what we, I think, as readers think are wise judgments in case after case. Mm. That separation, compartmentalization, one might call it, the ability to judge other people even if your own life is falling apart, I sense as a reader you quite admire that, but some people would take perhaps a different view.
Well, like all people who pride themselves on being reasonable, they can be immensely vulnerable when the tide of unreason sweeps over them. So the first thing Fiona does when her husband does indeed go off to have his affair is get the locks changed. And she has spent a lifetime telling clients not to do that. But it's a very bad move. You cannot bar the other party from access to property which they're generally, co-tenants or co-owners. I mean, she's compassionate in the strict sense of the term, but she does not extend this reasonableness to her own case.
We've talked about this engagement she has with this teenager, not yet 18, as I said. What gives it an extra added dimension is that she herself, presiding over the family court, in one sense, I won't say she has no family, because she does have a family, but she has no children. Mm. And that gives another dimension. And I know there's something there for you to read for us about her childlessness, and it may be helpful if you just read that bit.
It was a story best told at speed. After finals, more exams, then the call to the bar, pupillage, a lucky invitation to prestigious chambers, some early success defending hopeless cases. How sensible it had seemed to delay a child until her early 30s. And when those years came, they brought complex, worthwhile cases, more success. Jack was also hesitant, arguing for holding back another year or two. Mid-30s then, when he was teaching in Pittsburgh and she worked a 14-hour day, drifting deeper into family law as the idea of her own family receded, despite the visits of nephews and nieces. In the following years, the first rumors that she might be elected precociously to the bench and required to be on circuit. But the call didn't come, not yet. And in her 40s, there sprang up anxieties about elderly gravids and autism. Soon after, more young visitors to Gray's Inn Square, noisy, demanding great-nephews, great-nieces, reminding her how hard it would be to squeeze an infant into her kind of life. Then rueful thoughts of adoption, some tentative inquiries, and throughout the accelerating years that followed, occasional agonies of doubt, firm late-night decisions concerning surrogate mothers undone in the early morning rush to work. And when at last, at 9:30 one morning at the Royal Courts of Justice, she was sworn in by the Lord Chief Justice and took her oath of allegiance and her judicial oath before 200 of her bewigged colleagues, and she stood proudly before them in her robes, the subject of a witty speech, she knew the game was up. She belonged to the law, as some women had once been brides of Christ.
The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
To plunge into the family courts, people have said, or noted that this isn't something that you did have your own experience on. I'm going to leave it to you to say how much you want to say about that, but you did have some experience there involving an issue over custody. Were you wary of going into this because interviewers and others, as has happened this weekend just now with me, will ask you about it, or did you feel that, had that been sort of itching at you for the years since that experience, because you were thinking this is something I ought one day to write about?
Everyone who goes through this process finds it immensely painful, and I don't particularly want to talk about my own personal experience of it. But no, what brought me into this, I really came at this in another way. But I have strong memories of it, of course, but I don't think I want to write about it directly. I do have a passage there which I would want to read maybe at some point in this conversation, about the ease with which people contemplate divorce over the heads of their children, as it were. It's very easy to persuade yourself that it's... and self-persuasion is, again, another one of those very interesting human traits. We all suffer from it. To self-persuade that it's in your children's best interest that you destroy your marriage.
And their family
and
home.
And it rarely is. And so, and of course, people shouldn't be tied to each other for a lifetime if they're reluctant to be. But there is sometimes a sort of rather consumerist rush for a younger wife or a richer husband or a different lifestyle or something else. There's something which I think of as moral kitsch to this abandonment of children's interests. And it's as if, and I suppose what I would want is that we should all have that first, you know, when a man is about to leave a woman or a woman is about to leave a man, the child's interest should be the paramount consideration, not for the courts, but for the parents.
I'm going to move away from this particular novel until we come back to this question about religion, but just I want to ask you a few things just about, in some ways, method, which goes through all of the books, and that is, there is this engagement with the real, particularly the professional sphere. So in Readers of Solar, we'll have learnt a lot about climate change, and in Saturday we have a neuroscientist. Now it's the law courts. I'm just interested, in your writer's method, what comes first for you, whether it is a story, a situation, or a desire to mine and explore this other world of knowledge and work?
The work is never the first impulse, I mean, the background, but nevertheless, it's very important. One of the reasons I love Kipling's writing is because it's got people at work, and Conrad, too, is very good on work. Hemingway's rather good on work. And I think work went missing in the modernist novel for a while. Henry James rather liked his characters to have private incomes. He said so that he could get to the core of the human condition. This is what, they're still unhappy even though they don't have to work for a living. But I'm not persuaded by that. Life is a whole, and we are either slaves to our work, or we love it, or it is key to our identity. It's maybe the cause of great self-love or self-hatred. I mean, it's endless, boundless. Then there's just the fascination of other people's expertise. The two other work areas that still, one is airline pilots, and the other is architects. I love that novel by William Golding called The Spire, about the building of a medieval cathedral.
Some literary folk can be quite sniffy about the methods of research, etc. They will disparagingly say, well, that's kind of journalism, going out there with a notebook and finding out things, as if somehow literary endeavour would be purer, more like the Henry James model you were suggesting.
So, or the existential novel where, a character sits on the edge of a bed in an unnamed town, staring at the wall, waiting for a phone call, whose purpose we never discover, the kind of novel I loathe. And I sort of flirted with it in the 70s. My first two novels did not think it worthy to tell the reader what this town was, even though it was clearly Venice. And in my very first novel, Cement Garden, it never said when it was or where it was.
Would you write that differently now?
I would, yeah. I see no harm in saying what actually was the case in the Cement Garden. It was Stockwell, South London, in 1976.
But some part of your earlier self thought that would somehow lower the tone.
Yeah, yeah.
And make it perhaps less universal in some way, but did you?
Mistakenly, because in fact, all good novels are local, regional, specific. Mm. If you want a regional novel, read Anna Karenina, read Madame Bovary. I mean, they are regional specific novels par excellence. They are specific to a place.
The novels you write, particularly, not all of them, but are often short. Is that partly because you do think there is something, it's not quite at speed, but a story is best told concisely or with brevity?
I sort of resent the implication of some writers that if I write a short novel, it's because I can't write a long one. So I've written maybe four or five, and they've been interspersed with medium-length or longer novels. Mm. And I always feel behind these conversations is we're really talking about sexual prowess or something. It's really odd. How big is it? Size matters. There are great pleasures in the short novel, the speed of setting things up, the necessity of really paring down anything in the way of subplot, long divagationary passages, and always at one's back you have the examples, the supreme examples of the best novellas of Thomas Mann, Death in Venice, Kafka's Metamorphosis, which is I think of as a novella, my candidate for the greatest novella, but people don't think of it as one because it comes at the end of a book of short stories, is Joyce's The Dead. Mm. I don't think Joyce wrote a better 15, 20 pages of prose than The End of the Dead. It's very hard to write a 900-page novel that couldn't be shorter. So let's leave it at that.
Why don't we hear some questions from Rulio? I've got lots I want to ask, but well, it's a good point.
I've recently finished Sweet Tooth. I just wanted to ask, how much in that novel was it an exploration of your own genesis as a writer?
I first read Enduring Love as an A-level text, and you've spoken about that before, and I was just wondering whether you ever think about your other novels and consider their suitability for school study and think, wow, that would be a good one for them to study, that would be one I want to stay away from.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm very much struck by the fact that you write extremely convincing female characters, thinking particularly of Atonement. How significant is it in the Children Act that the judge is female?
I had very much in mind that the teenage Jehovah's Witness was a young man, so that was the first choice. And I wanted something powerful to develop emotionally between the judge and the teenager. And I couldn't quite see how that would happen without some strange overtones if it had been an elderly male judge and this boy. And it seemed to be more interesting, more haunting that she would see in him the child that she never had. And I couldn't quite see a male judge looking at a teenage boy and thinking of him in quite such strong, stark terms as the child he never had.
Your books are taught as part of the school syllabus. Do you have a view about which ones should be and which ones might not be? And
I wonder sometimes about forced reading. Will those readers forced to read you give you any thanks in later life? He's heard this story many times. My son Greg is actually here tonight. He had to do Enduring Love. And two things remain in memory from this, and he'll excuse me if I tell this story yet again, but it was a very strange thing to find lying around the sitting room in his handwriting sentences on A4 saying things like, in this passage, McEwen, something. And then this other bit we dispute. He thinks I've brushed up this anecdote, but anyway, here it goes. I did once give him a full hour of my thoughts on an essay that he was going to write an essay, and I said, well, you know, this is what I think. It came back with a D. Now, wait a minute, he says it was a C.
I just want to return you to something you mentioned at the beginning. We didn't get into it then, but it's obviously part of the story of Children Act, and it's just very much a question of our times, and that is about faith. In fact, in both of the two sort of big cases that you deal with, there's faith is the issue, the two ultra-Orthodox Jewish parents and then the Jehovah's Witness family. Simon Sharma said the other day that it is one of the great surprises of the 21st century is the persistence of religion, and he referred to his own grammar school teacher, who in what he describes the quite idealistic time of post-war Britain said, you know, the one thing we can take for granted is that by the end of the 20th century, nationalism and religion will be almost gone. They will have receded. And here we are in 2014.
Now we watch this rampage across northern Syria, northern Iraq, and, you know, we're powerless. It's beyond our moral equations. One thing to maybe go on the rampage converting people, but just slaughtering them wholesale, causing one of the largest disruptions of population UN spokesman was now saying 100,000 a month this morning. And then we're faced with damned if we do and damned if we don't. We intervene, but the terrible past of Iraq is behind our shoulders, and yet nor can we stand by. And yet can we separate humanitarian aid from military intervention? I'm not sure these things are possible in separate.
Are your instincts quite, I don't want to use the word hawkish, but are they activist in this area rather than sitting back and just thinking, well, that's the way the world is? Do you feel the urge to this country, other countries, the United States, should act for when confronted with something like ISIS?
I think reluctantly this is so extreme that something has to be done militarily to stop the Islamic State. But I say it very reluctantly because we've nothing much good comes of even more violence piled on violence. But here, could we ever live with ourselves if we just sat on our hands while Muslims of the wrong faith, or Christians, or atheists, or just other Muslims who seem to be the main victims in this case, are put to the sword. I mean, seeing pictures of 200 soldiers with their arms on their head being marched in their underpants into the middle of the desert to be slaughtered yesterday. It seems like, well, we were talking about this earlier, Jonathan. We seem this summer to have lived through the darkest news cycle I can remember. The unforetellable nature of events in eastern Ukraine, Rotherham, Ebola, northern Iraq. Sometimes I feel like a rabbit in the headlights with this.
And what do you do with that? I mean, do you look at it and stare at it in the sense of reading about it and listening to it, or do you feel the urge to look away and immerse yourself in, you know, rereading Virginia Woolf rather than dealing with what's going on now?
I become a news junkie all over again. I listen sometimes from 6 o'clock onwards to the Today program. I'm there at the World at 1. I listen to the 7 o'clock news and generally round it out with Newsnight, having read the broadsheets of the New York Times. So if you don't hear from me again in the way of novels, you know, I haven't got time for it. I try and tell myself that actually we mustn't exaggerate our own importance, as it were, historically, because we're living at this time. But in other moods, I think we really are on some pivot. Perhaps the European Union is going to break up. Perhaps, who can guess the mind of Putin? Perhaps it'll all fizzle out next year. We'll say, well, we've got rather used to East and West Ukraine. Rather nicer in the West Ukraine, and people in the East are voting with their feet. And thank God we didn't have a Third World War, but, you know, plenty of else to worry about. But I can't help feeling, I can't resist this sense that Europe is becoming, you know, home to such brilliant thoughts about human rights and to the great enterprise of modernity and science, and great literature, is becoming less and less relevant on the world stage. Its voice and its notions of human dignity and freedom becoming smaller and smaller and less capable of defending itself or promoting itself. I think these are anxious times.
It only remains for me to join all of you, I'm sure, in thanking our guest who shared so much time and insight with us, Ian McEwan.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.